Today on Pilot's Discretion, our guest is venture capitalist, founder, and former flight test engineer, Ben Marcus. He tells us about emerging technology in aviation, drone delivery companies, and flying light jets. Pilot's Discretion starts right now. Welcome, everyone. I'm John Zimmerman, and thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion from Sporties. Remember to visit sporties.com/podcast for show links and complete archives, and send us an email with your comments or guest ideas, podcast@sporties.com. Today, it's my pleasure to have Ben Marcus on the show. He is one of the most connected people in the aviation industry, having worked at a wide variety of roles at a wide variety of companies. He started at Eclipse Aviation in the mid-2000s, then founded Jet Aviva, a well-known jet brokerage and training company, before starting a drone software company. Today, he is managing partner at Up Partners, a company that invests in technologies that help move people and goods cleaner, faster, safer, and at lower cost. Ben is also a flight instructor and ATP with multiple jet type ratings. Ben, welcome to Pilot's Discretion.
Thank you for inviting me, John. Great to be here.
Every year, Up Partners releases the Moving World Report, which reviews trends in mobility, and this goes from sea freight to space flight and everything in between. Very broad report. The 2024 edition is out now and has a number of fascinating stats, and not surprisingly, I wanted to focus on some of those aviation stats and trends. So let's begin with every headline writer's favorite, which is flying cars. Now, I personally think it's a terrible phrase. I'm guessing you do too. Most of these aren't cars at all. But the bigger mistake here, I feel like, is it lumps together a lot of very different aircraft under one heading. So a great example I'd like to start with is Pivotal, who has just started delivering their personal flying aircraft, Helix, which doesn't even require a pilot's license. It's a Part 103 ultralight. This is not the five-seat, you know, Joby Archer kind of product out there. So who's the target customer for some of these small, single-seat, more sport-flying aircraft?
You know, I was first inspired about the future of so-called flying cars as a kid growing up in Southern California, having the privilege of learning to fly and flying above the traffic in Los Angeles and looking down on those packed highways thinking, why is it that I get to be the lucky one up here in the sky and all these other people are miserable, stuck in traffic beneath me? How do we get more people to come up into the sky and share this magic of aviation? And I think that that's exactly what these aircraft like Pivotal are going to enable. It really brings general aviation to the masses. And initially, that will be people using these for recreational purposes. Initially, you know, in sort of uncongested places on farms and in rural areas and so forth. But eventually, I could see this evolving into the type of aircraft that could be used by tourists at resorts if you want to go for a cool flight over the beach or through a natural park. And ultimately, I hope that they also serve in the role of a commuter. I think that with such a small footprint, you have the potential to create a scaled transportation system without the extensive need for physical infrastructure the way you will with larger eVTOLs. So it could be that eventually you will hail your air scooter and it will show up empty and you jump in and it takes you where you need to go.
Well, let's compare and contrast that to the better known options, probably for many listeners who they've read about, Joby, Beta. We've had both of those companies on this podcast, but I'm interested in your perspective on the broader industry now that many of these are getting pretty close to certification, at least the finish line is in sight here. So if the Helix and what they're doing is going to be more of that personal transportation or even recreational, what's the business model for these larger eVTOLs? Is that going to be really the mass market product like Uber once envisioned, or is it more going to be like the business jet fractional industry of today?
I really hope that it becomes a mass market product. I think that's the vision for these companies. And yes, there will be a phase where the economics are such that it really only works for a smaller handful of folks. But over time, as the takeoff and landing infrastructure grows, there's more sites and this becomes a more ubiquitous way of getting around and the cost comes down, I think that you will see it become more of a mass market service, a new modality of transportation. That will take decades because today we don't have a sufficient number of landing facilities to create the utility that you really need to be able to commute around cities. So initially, a lot of these companies are talking about the sort of airport shuttle use case. So you land at JFK and you want to get to Manhattan. It's a good way to do that and skip, you know, an hour of traffic. I think there's going to be interesting sort of vacation and traveling salesman type use cases in polyopolis places like Los Angeles. You know, if you're living in Los Angeles and you want to get to Santa Barbara for the weekend, or let's say you're a salesman living in Orange County and you need to make a sales call in San Diego, it's a good way to get around. So I think those will be the initial use cases. I'm also really excited about cargo and logistics. So Beta in particular, which is one of our portfolio companies here at UpPartners, is focused on cargo and logistics initially, which has a lesser requirement for infrastructure because the places where you would load and unload cargo already have quite a bit of real estate, like at a warehouse, in a parking lot or on the roof of the warehouse. So we think that that is really the starting point for electric vertical aircraft. And over time, they will move more and more into passenger use cases.
And what's the key breakthrough from a technology, but maybe more importantly, a business model standpoint here? Is it the electric? Is it the vertical part of it? Is it the semi-autonomous and maybe someday fully autonomous flight? What's the key piece there that makes this different than just doing this in a Bell or a Sikorsky helicopter today?
Well, the two things really are cost and safety. So for a long time, helicopters have flown around cities, but in limited numbers. There have been helicopter airlines, famously in New York, I believe in the 60s or 70s, in Los Angeles. We had Los Angeles Airways that used to fly people from LAX to Disneyland, and in San Francisco. And in all cases, they shut down because of accidents. So, you know, helicopters are safe for people who fly them. You know, there's, let's just say round numbers, approximately one accident per 100,000 flight hours. So if you fly even a very robust helicopter piloting career of 20,000 hours, chances are you're not going to be in an accident. But if you're talking about a scaled transportation system with millions of people flying in these things over a city every day, you're going to have many accidents every day. And that's not something that I think the general population is prepared to accept. We're used to accidents on the highways, but those are not as scary as things falling from the sky. So we needed to increase the level of safety, and distributed electric propulsion contributes to that because these are much more redundant and reliable than the complex systems in helicopters. And as you start to introduce more autonomy into these systems, we have the potential of reducing accidents that are caused by human error. And that is the majority of helicopter accidents. So if we can increase the level of safety by 10x over existing helicopters, I think that we have the potential to crack that code. The second is on cost. Helicopters, of course, are quite expensive to operate. And the potential of electric aircraft brings that cost down. How much is yet to be determined. Certainly, there's no liquid fuel cost, but batteries are expendable. Batteries will only last so long. They don't last as long as turbine engines, but they last longer than, you know, than one tank of gas, let's say, right? So they're kind of, if you think about them, they're not quite the hourly sort of consumable of fuel, but they are much more consumable than an engine that has a 4,000 hour TBO. So exactly how much that costs on a per hour, per mile basis is really yet to be determined. But I do believe that they'll be significantly less costly to operate than a helicopter.
How about from the funding standpoint, something you're involved deeply with here? Cost estimates vary, but I've heard $1 billion to $3 billion to certify a brand new clean sheet aircraft. That's pretty much true, whether you're talking about a business jet or an eVTOL. And then you've got to deliver it, obviously, and support it. So traditionally, venture capital has not been a source of funding for a lot of aerospace projects, at least on the small side of things. You know, Cessna and Beech and the classic GA companies were sort of family businesses. Venture capital has flooded into this market in a big way. What do you think is appealing? Is it that potential for scale, or is something else changed about the market that makes it attractive?
Well, it is still very difficult to capitalize these companies. Yes, venture capital has come into the space, but it's been paired with strategic investment from suppliers and from potential customers, airlines like United and Delta and so forth, suppliers like Toyota, which has invested heavily in Joby, and other automotive makers and other companies as well. And then the public markets in the SPAC craze of 2021 and early 2022 helped bring a lot of capital in these companies as well, which has been critical in their progress. That said, it's still extremely challenging to get one of these aircraft to certification, especially in a novel design. You know, this is something that's never been done before. Electric powered lift is new. Autonomy is new. And so there's a lot yet to be figured out, in terms of how you get something like this certified. So, I think that, we're still a ways away. There's still a lot of work to be done. I think that the companies that are successful will find ways to start to, sell their products pre-certification. So the military market, for example, is one that, is quite appealing to many companies, and you're already seeing quite a bit of defense budget going into these eVTOL companies early on. And I think that will help stimulate these businesses and help them get the capital that they need to get through a civil certification process.
That's a key piece I think some people overlook, is just how important the role of the military is in developing these new technologies. You point this out in the report this year about how critical the military has been for funding key technology leaps in the past, and certainly seems important here. The other one, as you mentioned, airlines, but also when it comes to the world of drone delivery and another exciting area many people are focused on, some people might be surprised by the big players in that world. In particular, you highlight Walmart and how really aggressive they have become in the drone delivery space. So tell us about that market and how realistic it is. It seems like that is actually further along than the eVTOL stuff that you read about a lot.
Yeah, it's not been hampered to the same extent. I shouldn't say hampered, but the regulatory requirements for drone delivery have not been as pacing an item for drone delivery as it has been for eVTOLs. And Walmart has been, you know, very creative about how they've gone about coming into this business. Walmart is, you know, a very creative company with very talented individuals, and they have taken a partnership approach to developing their drone delivery business. So they've partnered with many drone delivery companies like Zipline, DroneUp, Flytrex, and others. And others, like Amazon, for example, have taken more of a do-it-yourself approach, investing a lot of capital and building their own team to build a drone delivery system. Walmart's approach seems to be paying off because they've been able to get the best of the best without having to invest very significant capital. And it's working. They're now, you know, delivering packages from many of their stores to surrounding communities. And people love it. The consumers absolutely love being able to tap a button on their phone and take delivery of whatever it is. You want your SpaghettiOs for your kid, or you've run out of toilet paper, or whatever it is. Tap the button, and a few minutes later, your stuff arrives. So that's quite an exciting development. you know, these aircraft are so far operating essentially within line of sight. There are some initial beyond visual line of sight exemptions that the FAA has granted that have allowed these things to operate, but still with some sort of visual observer monitoring the airspace around the area of operation to make sure that the drones don't interfere with manned aircraft operations. That will change again soon as the FAA releases new regulations around beyond visual line of sight of flight, and that is going to allow for more scaled operations. So yeah, that's quite an exciting you know, development. I think that you're going to start to see more drone delivery operations beyond just consumers. We didn't really talk about that much in the report, but there's a lot of middle mile and first mile operations of drones that are going to be necessary to bring, you know, raw material, for example, from mines and so forth to processing facilities, and then middle mile, bringing goods between distribution centers. Things like what Beta will be able to do with its eVTOL and their partnership with UPS, which has been publicly announced, but also other larger drone developers that can move, for example, 500 pounds over a couple hundred miles. You can imagine small towns in Wyoming or Montana or Alaska between islands in Hawaii, where it's quite difficult to move, you know, sort of the equivalent of a UPS, you know, brown package car load over several hundred miles. Now you can do that with a medium-sized drone or even a piloted eVTOL. So there's a lot of really interesting applications that are under development, and we're excited for all of them.
Let's talk about the potential trickle-down benefits of all this investment in new technology. A lot of listeners to this podcast are GA pilots like you, maybe wondering, will any of this eventually find its way into something I can fly? You know, I've heard people talk about the dividends from the massive investment in the smartphones in the last decade, that so many things got less expensive with the investment in smartphones, and that trickled down into other areas of life. Is there a potential there for GA flying benefiting from this investment in either electric propulsion or airframe design or autonomous flying? What might we see over the next decade?
Absolutely. And we're already seeing it in how we fly on a daily basis. I mean, I use my iPad and my iPhone when I fly my airplane, and now connects with my Garmin avionics system. Really cool company, Microavionics or UAvionics, that you may be familiar with, that makes very inexpensive ADS-B systems, got their start because they wanted to serve the drone market and now have STC'd products for general aviation aircraft. Electrification, you see companies like Pipistrel, which was recently acquired by Textron, that's, you know, delivering an electric aircraft initially for training, but more and more, I think we're going to see electric airplanes for general aviation that have longer ranges. So we're already seeing this technology making its way into general aviation, and it will continue to get better. I like, for example, look at the Garmin Autoland system that's come out in the last few years. Yes, it's an important safety system for general aviation to allow passengers to press a button and have the aircraft land in an emergency if there's a pilot incapacitation or something else. But I'm sure that the reason why Garmin worked on that, you know, spans far beyond just the emergency use case. I'm sure this is a initial foray into what ultimately could be a broader autonomy system that could be utilized in other types of aircraft. So I think that you are seeing the benefits of that technology and that investment already making its way into general aviation.
And what do you think the biggest challenge is on that autonomy subject? And I don't want to derail us into the whole pilotless airliner conversation, but it seems like there's a technology challenge, an economics challenge, a regulation challenge, and just a general social acceptance culture. Out of those four, which do you think is the biggest challenge to surmount in the next decade?
Well, you know, airliners have had a lot of autonomy capabilities for a long time. I mean, 747s have had Autoland for 40 years. So I don't think it's a technology issue. Yes, I mean, what we're talking about now in terms of fully autonomous flight, you know, from gate to gate, taxi out, take off, fly, land, taxi in, is much more than what Autoland has historically been able to do. But it's not a technology challenge. I think that regulators have some challenges to figure out how to deal with non-deterministic systems. They're used to, you know, looking at a safety system and saying, oh, if this happens, then it reacts in that way. But to get the real power of modern technology, we need to accept artificial intelligence, which means ultimately you need to understand how to certify non-deterministic systems. And but I think the biggest of the challenges is really the public acceptance. I don't think, at least in my lifetime, I don't anticipate that human beings are going to want to be flown around in you know, quantities measuring in the hundreds at a time with no pilots on board. So I expect that airlines will continue to be, you know, flown by human beings. It may be that smaller aircraft, can be flown fully autonomously eventually. You know, maybe these eVTOLs that have four or five passengers will be flown fully autonomously. I think that that's still quite some time off. but in the meantime, I do think that cargo aircraft will be much better suited to autonomous operation, where you don't have the same, you know, human agency problem that you have with being on board the aircraft.
Yeah, I read a recent study from, I can't remember the academic's name, but the concept was moral crumple zones. And that's a key role that humans play in a lot of these automated systems, which is a really terrible name to give humans sitting in the left seat. But there's something to be said for that, that there's a role to be played there in a social way. One other question on electric specifically. There's some designs out there that are more or less bolting an electric motor onto an existing airframe design. That's Pipistrel. Bayer Aerospace has proposed some airplane designs along those lines. And then you have the more clean sheet approaches, including some eStall aircraft, which don't really take off vertically, but mount a series of motors on the wings for very, very short takeoff and landing. Do you think the more clean sheet design is the right answer that takes advantage of electric, or is the more traditional airplane design with an upgraded power plant the better option?
It's a bit of a loaded question because I think it goes in phases. I mean, the often the easier approach to get something to market is to just take one innovation at a time. And so, you know, easier to put some new type of motor on an existing airframe, probably takes a little less capital to, you know, to get to market. But ultimately, new technologies mean that there's new ways to optimize a whole system. And so eventually these aircraft will have to be, you know, clean sheet designs, just like we're seeing with the eVTOLs that are being developed now. But there are some very exciting eStall designs. I think there's a lot of benefit to eStall even over eVTOL in many cases. An eVTOL is really hyper optimized for vertical flight, and that reduces a lot of its range capability and so forth. So if you have a few hundred feet to take off, rather than, you know, just a 50-foot square for a helipad, that extra space can go a long way in creating a much more capable aircraft with more payload and range. So yeah, I'm excited about the eStall concept as well. And yeah, looking forward to seeing how those develop in the next few years.
Ben, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to ask you about business jets.
Earn all your pilot ratings and keep your flying skills sharp with Sporty's Pilot Training Plus. This all-inclusive membership unlocks Sporty's complete library of award-winning video courses so you can learn anywhere you have your phone, tablet, or laptop. For one annual fee, you get access to over $1,500 in courses, a smart investment in your flying career. Plus, enjoy free shipping every day of the year at sporties.com and apply for one of our three annual flight training scholarships. Learn more at sporties.com/pilot training. Now, back to Pilot's Discretion.
We are back with Ben Marcus, who has a long and varied career in aviation, including at Jet Aviva, a company he founded in 2006. Ben, between that and Eclipse, you've probably talked to more light jet owners and pilots than anyone I know. And so I'm curious about your report card on this segment of the industry. You know, in the early 2000s, we had this explosion of new category of airplanes, very light jets, the Citation Mustang, Phenom 100, many, many more designs. Do you think those airplanes brought new people into the industry and grew the pie, or did we just reshuffle existing pilots into different airplanes?
I know it grew the pie. My friend Cyrus Sagari and I, who we co-founded Jet Aviva together, you know, we first became excited about the category in 1999 when we saw the first brochure for the Eclipse 500. At the time, we were seniors in high school and went to college for aeronautics at Purdue. And Cyrus started interning at Eclipse during his engineering training at Purdue. I later joined after graduating Purdue in 2004. And, you know, we saw a lot of people transitioning from propeller airplanes to jets for the first time because of the Eclipse 500. And then as time went on, unfortunately, Eclipse didn't make it, but Cessna continued with the Citation Mustang and Embraer with the Phenom 100. Of course, now Cirrus with the Cirrus jet. And we see a lot of people flying jets today that would not have flown jets if it weren't for that category of aircraft. I think if we extend that a little bit, you also see a lot of people coming into aviation today because flying an airplane is how should I say, it's much more like operating a computer than it used to be. And I think we can credit Cirrus with a lot of that innovation, even, you know, with the SR22 line. So it's really exciting to see how aviation is transforming. And I do think that the pie is growing. And now through COVID, we've seen a whole lot of new entrants, you know, into aviation because they, you know, didn't want to fly on the airlines. So really excited about the new sort of rebound in general aviation excitement.
As far as training, what's your best advice for that pilot who's stepping up into a jet for the first time? Maybe they're coming out of an SR-22, maybe it's a turboprop. What is something they should make sure they focus on?
Well, back in 2006, when we first got started with Jet Aviva, we were providing a lot of jet familiarization training for people who had never flown a jet before. And the most important thing was being proficient on instruments before making the leap and getting some familiarity with the avionics. I think if you're comfortable with the avionics suite, then you don't have to learn it going 300 knots, right? And there's so many tools now that you can use to prepare for learning those avionics systems, whether it be ground-based simulators on your personal computer or flight training devices. If you're transitioning into an airplane with Garmin, for example, which is most of these airplanes, getting some experience flying a 172 with the same avionics at slower speed goes a long way to helping with the jet transition. You know, operating the jet itself, you know, is not that complicated. You don't need to be an expert on how the systems work really anymore because they're mostly automated. But you do need to be able to think on your feet, think ahead of the airplane, fly in a very orchestrated, choreographed way, doing things the same way each time. And that's just much easier to learn if you're not having to learn how to fly instruments or learn the avionics suite at the same time.
The insurance market's gotten a little interesting in the light jet world recently, especially for a single pilot. And some people, including some insurance companies, argue that single pilot owner-operated jets just aren't a good idea, and more of these jets should be flown two-pilot. How would you respond after flying with a lot of pilots in these airplanes over the years?
Yeah, I don't think the data supports that. Aviation insurance is not underwritten by data. There's really just no actuarial approach to aviation insurance. So I think a lot needs to be done to bring real information to these insurance decisions. Now we have a lot of tools in the cockpit that have the potential to record information about how the aircraft are being operated. And I wish that that data was actually being used in making underwriting decisions. I don't have the latest data, but when I was really focused on this between 2006 and 2014, light jet accidents were much more common with professionally flown two-pilot crews than single-pilot owner-flown operations. Again, that was between 2006 and 2014. And I think the reasons are that usually the owner-flown pilot, you know, owner-flown aircraft, they don't have to depart at a certain time. If the weather's bad or they don't feel quite right, they can wait till tomorrow. And the professional pilots, you know, had a need to go. I mean, of course, you can say, no, it's not a good day to fly, but you feel the pressure. You have passengers expecting to get from one place to another or whatever. And so they ended up flying in worse conditions and sometimes making poor choices. So I think that we found historically that these owner pilots actually have pretty good judgment. They tend to go to the same training that professional pilots go to. They tend to perform that training in the same way that professional pilots perform. Of course, there's outliers that have challenges and need help, but I would really encourage the insurance companies to look at the data and make better decisions.
Such a great point. The ability to not fly today or not fly right now may be the most powerful tool that the average GA pilot has. Unlike the airlines or cargo, where you really the incentive is to go unless it's absolutely unflyable. GA pilot, owner operator can decide just doesn't feel right. And that can be a powerful safety tool if used properly.
Right.
Ben, we always end pilot's discretion with a lightning round we call ready to copy. I'll ask some questions on a wide range of topics and you give me your quick answer. So are you ready to copy?
Yep, let's do it.
There's a quote from Boeing in the Moving World Report. 80% of living humans today have never flown on an airplane, which is amazing and yet makes perfect sense when you think about the world and that's 7 billion plus people. How low can we realistically get that number? 50%? 20%? How many people in the next 50 years can we get flying?
In 50 years, I think we could get to, I hope that 80% of human beings will be able to fly in 50 years.
UP Partners publishes the AAM Reality Index as a part of that report. It ranks companies based on their likelihood of succeeding, and it's a long list of companies in this industry right now. So I'm not going to ask you which one's going to fail, but if one of them does, what will be the most likely cause? Is it just money, or is there something more complicated that could be the iceberg?
Ultimately, companies fail because they run out of money, but that's caused by a number of issues. You know, the wrong product market fit, the wrong team, the wrong approach to selling the product, but ultimately it's because you ran out of money.
Will we have one dominant charging network for electric aircraft? There's been some news on this recently with Beta putting in with signature FBOs. There's been some other people pursuing other opportunities. Do you think this will all coalesce around one, or will we have competing plugs out there?
I don't think we'll have competing plugs. I think there will be a common charging standard, but I do think there will be multiple service stations, if you will, places where you can fill your battery with power.
What do you think is the best light jet on the market today for an owner-operator? If you were back running Jet Aviva and you had a customer stepping up out of a Meridian, say, into a light jet, what would you send them towards?
Well, my favorite single-pilot jet is the Phenom 300 by far. I think it's the best single-pilot jet out there. It might be a little bit of a jump from a Meridian, but that would be my target.
You've also, in addition to jets, done some flying in the Game Bird, if I'm not mistaken, a very, very interesting looking aerobatic airplane. Anybody, if you haven't seen it, you absolutely want to look it up on YouTube. Describe what it's like flying that airplane.
I love the Game Bird. It's my morning coffee. I get to the airport 7:30 a.m. Three or four times a week and fly before work starts. Thankfully, I can work on the airport. My office is at Santa Monica Airport, so it makes it convenient. But the Game Bird is a high performance plus and minus 10G all carbon fiber airplane certified by the FAA, built in Bentonville, Arkansas, by a wonderful company called Game Composites. And I've had the pleasure of owning and flying one for 2.5 years. And it's a blast. It's as long as you've got altitude beneath you, you can really explore all corners of the flight envelope. And it does amazing things. It flies incredibly well in full stalls. You have full aileron authority. You can tumble it, which is one of my favorite things to do, with some really cool gyroscopic maneuvers. It's a great airplane to fly in formation. I have a formation buddy here in LA that we fly together doing formation aerobatics. So really fun way to build friendships and camaraderie with other aviators that are also passionate about aerobatics.
All right. You mentioned Bentonville, Arkansas, an area that has quietly become one of the most interesting places to fly in the U.S. I feel like many pilots may not know this, but lots of great backcountry flying there. Do you have a favorite strip in that area of Northwest Arkansas?
My favorite backcountry strip in Northwest Arkansas is Gaston's. If you haven't been there, I highly recommend it. Beautiful manicured grass strip in between trees and a nice little town right on the river. Great spot to stop, get a root beer float. They've got a great little restaurant and lodge there. Super fun. Great community. Beautiful place.
All right, prediction time. I'm going to put you on the spot here. What are the chances I can book a supersonic flight by 2035?
I'm afraid I'm a little bit of a pessimist on supersonic flight. I think that more likely is you'll be able to book a hypersonic flight probably by 2045 than a supersonic flight by 2035.
And how about space flight? There's some people talking about that, not just the tourist, you know, rocket shots, but something more regular in terms of transportation. You think the prospects for that longer term are realistic?
That's one that I would lump into the hypersonic category. So I think there's a bunch of ways that people will be able to move around the planet at extremely high speeds. One is through rockets. Another is sort of space planes, atmospheric gliders that will skip across the top of the atmosphere. But yes, I do think that there's a good chance you'll be able to fly from one point on Earth to another in a rocket in the course of 60 minutes.
Business aviation has made some promises about net zero emissions by 2050. Some people think that's great. Some people think they're wildly optimistic. What do you think?
Well, getting aviation to net zero is a big challenge. I think that SAF is one small part of the solution, but I think we need better aerodynamics. The existing tube and wing structure of airplanes is not the most efficient way to move through the air. I think we need to find other alternative sources of fuel, like hydrogen, for example, that will be much greener. Ultimately, it comes down to renewable energy. Can we source enough renewable energy, solar, nuclear, and so forth, to produce these e-fuels and do it in an environmentally sustainable way? And so will that happen by 2050? I don't think we're going to be at net zero by 2050, but I think we'll be a long ways toward net zero.
What's the best advice you've ever received as a founder?
Focus on the customer.
And is that the best advice you now give to founders?
Yes, with more context, but yeah, I think, you know, customers are everything. We need to develop products that customers actually want to use. And as long as you can do that and deliver a great value proposition to your customer, you can build a good business.
What is the biggest misconception about drones right now?
Well, I hear many people in the pilot community concerned about the potential of collisions with drones. And that certainly is possible. But, you know, we've had millions of things flying in the airspace without transponders for a long time. They're called birds. And we hit them from time to time. You know, unfortunately, they can cause some damage. But I don't think that there's a high likelihood of major catastrophic, you know, collisions between small drones and aircraft. And I do see that there are more and more safety systems making their way into the drone world through things like ADS-B, like remote identification, like unmanned aircraft traffic management, and so forth, that will continually enhance the safety of the drone and manned aircraft interface as the number of drones scale.
All right, Ben, our last question is always the same on this podcast. You have one final flight, and we want to know, what are you flying and where are you going?
Man, that's tough. So for me, aviation is becoming more of an experience than what it is that I'm flying. And what I love about aviation is the ability to connect with people that you ordinarily wouldn't connect with otherwise. And so I think my final flight would be a journey to someplace in the world that I've never visited before, taking my family and getting to know how other people live, what their culture is like, and, you know, experiencing that sort of face-to-face interaction with other human beings that I ordinarily wouldn't have interacted with.
Ben, thanks for being on the podcast.
Great to be here.
Thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion, brought to you by Sporties, training and equipping pilots worldwide for over 60 years. For more episodes and today's show links, visit sporties.com/podcast. I'm John Zimmerman. We'll see you next time on Pilot's Discretion.